I continued with a description of this alternative description of classical GR in terms of gauge theory, like variables, goes by the name of Ashtaka variables usually, and attempts to build a canonical quantum gravity theory building on these classical parameterization. I also told you that, I mean, the beauty of that and the beauty of the analogy becomes only apparent after 3 plus 1 decomposition and a partial gauge fixing, which puts one then on a configuration space that consists of SO3 or closely related SU2 valued gauge potentials and the associated momenta. And you can, in principle, certainly classically in a straightforward manner, rewrite like classical Einstein equations, but also the constraints we are particularly interested in terms of these variables. They had now a new, an additional gauge degree of freedom. These variables corresponding to internal kind of frame rotations at every point of the kind of the associated momenta, which looked essentially kind of dry binds. That, of course, made the analogy, the close analogy clear with a Young-Mills theory. But really, this is confined to kind of the kinematical level of that one is talking about the same phase space. Of course, the dynamics and the constraint structure is rather different. Now, I had explained to you that a neat set of kind of coordinates in an infinite dimensional sense on the space of gauge potentials, modulo gauge transformations, is given by these Wilson loops. And you learned, hopefully yesterday, how to work with these in the exercises. The point being that if I take kind of a holonomy that is just an integral of the gauge potential along an open path, it still transforms non-trivially at the endpoints. But when I then identify the endpoints, as I do when I talk about a loop, and the resulting takes a trace of the resulting holonomy matrix, then it's straightforward to show that it no longer transforms under gauge transformation. So it's a gauge invariant quantity with respect to the local SE2 gauge transformations. And that, of course, would hold for any other gauge group too. These quantities, these Wilson loops, they contain, in principle, all the information one is interested in. But one's task is now kind of to reformulate everything, in particular the canonical quantization, based on a space of wave functions that is just labeled by these Wilson loops. And I told you that, well, some further consideration brings one to the realization that one needs to study intersecting loops, and that leads one, I mean, I'm cutting a long story very short, and I'm not giving you much of the details. It leads to the fact that a very nice basis of this Hilbert space is gets a label of so-called spin networks. So spin networks are also just one-dimensional. They're based on one-dimensional graphs, so you can think of them as some version of Wilson loops, where it's not loops necessarily, but kind of intersecting graphs that are kind of label the arguments of the wave functions, plus a bunch of additional kind of representation theoretic labels, kind of the J labels of SU2 representation. Now, we're not going to dwell on this much longer. Of course, we haven't yet imposed the other constraints, the momentum constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint in this framework. So roughly speaking, how this goes for the momentum constraint is that one says, aha, well, if I want to get two states that not just solve so kind of the quantized Gauss constraint when I apply it, but also the momentum constraint, then I have to make them functionals of, well, of equivalence classes, not just of loops or whatever they are, graphs, but of diffeomorphism equivalence classes of such objects. So I'm then just choosing functionals of A in a way that only depend on the equivalence class of such a graph assignment. So that's the rough idea. So that they are just constant when I move kind of this graph argument or this loop argument by a three-dimensional diffeomorphism. So roughly speaking, I mean, that's, again, a very crude description, but this is roughly speaking what happens. And then, of course, one's task remains, what to do with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So what to do with the Hamiltonian constraint. And here only, so here one has made considerable progress. Also, there's a very nice result due to Tiemann from 1996, that if I can actually make the algebra of kind of the quantum gravity part of the constraint algebra given by this H hat mu, a closed on-shell. So that means, of course, on a space of wave functions that are annihilated by all of the constraints. So that's due to Tiemann 1996. And of course, to say that, he had to make a specific implementation of this H-perp, I mean, this Hamiltonian constraint operator. And this is by no means unique, the choice that he made there. Roughly speaking, the action of this Hamiltonian operator, when applied kind of on such a state, is to kind of manipulate kind of the underlying the graph gamma by adding edges, subtracting edges. I mean, it's kind of discrete operations on the underlying graph. This is how the Hamiltonian acts kind of generically. Of course, the details, as I said, this is not in any way uniquely fixed. Now, why? Well, this is nice, but it's falls still a little bit short of what one would like to do. So what does this imply? Well, one computes the algebra of these quantum operators, and one finds that, well, on kind of what one considers physical wave functions, the right-hand sides are zero. Now, what would be nice to show that if one goes off-shell, that one finds something that is or reminds one of the classical Dirac algebra. So this is a weaker statement. It's nice, but it's a weaker statement. So so what are other issues that have to do with kind of finishing the Dirac quantization program in this formulation? Well, not only kind of the regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint, its non-uniqueness. Obviously, there are factor ordering issues. Well, there has also been criticism of this discrete representation of the Hamiltonian, because there is an argument that says it just acts very locally on spin networks, in a way that is too local and therefore doesn't capture the physics properly, and therefore is unable ultimately to cover kind of one is unable to recover the full geometric information that sits in the classical Dirac algebra at the quantum level. But again, it's not arguments I can go into. Of course, one very obvious argument why this is still complete, even if one has such a result, is that one still has to solve the equation, of course, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And that, one would say, is unfortunately almost as intractable as it was in the geometric picture, especially since I told you, you know, I wrote down the functional form of this, and I told you, well, there's a second, a very functionally complicated term that we also have to consider. So that's still, well, some people still keep trying, but it's clearly a very challenging task. Now, and there, but there are whole books, of course, that have been written on this approach. In particular, there are two books appeared in Cambridge University Press. One is by Ralph Rovelli, who, as I said already, will be here later this year, on loop quantum gravity. And the other one is by Thiemann, 2007, who is the person who, with his group, is still very much pushing to complete this quantization program here. Yes?
Has the Wheeler-Dibbitt equation been solved?
No. No, that's just what I'm pointing out. I mean, when one doesn't know where to start, of course, one can try many things. I mean, discretization, you know, putting, forcing things on a lattice, for example, is one thing, or trying to develop, you know, an approximation scheme where you maybe can address this in some kind of order by order perturbation theory. Well, of what is this in the question? So, well, many clever people have thought already quite hard about this problem. Well, I mean, you know, I've worked on this approach for many years of my life, starting after my PhD thesis, as a matter of fact, because also then it was kind of the new, interesting, and exciting idea that was around in quantum gravity. I think, ultimately, one is stuck at similar points, although one has pushed this much, much further in terms of, you know, the well-definedness of the kinematical formalism up to the point where one has to address the dynamics. So is this the right way to go? It's a legitimate question. Of course, the ultimate answer is we don't know. We don't really know, but there are, yeah, certainly some major problems associated with this equation, with this Wheeler-DeWitt equation also in this approach. And everything looks very nice and kind of discrete, and you have nice geometric operators that correspond to areas and volumes, and they have operator spectra which are computable, at least in part, and finite, and you can try and interpret them in some physical way. But really, this is all modulo having solved the dynamics. And that is a serious, I mean, that's, of course, a serious a drawback. And it might, of course, be that kind of infinities sneak back in once you get to Hamiltonians that kind of do the right thing or are realistic Hamiltonian constraints. But as I said, this is still very much an open game. And if any one of you wants to take up research, they should certainly seriously look at this. Now, I had, at this stage, I wanted to quote from one of the founding fathers of the subject, who has already come up, Bryce DeWitt. So in his later years, he took a strong dislike towards his own formula, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So here I just quote to you from it's just a conference abstract about, of course, he didn't call it the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, he just called it that equation. And he says in the abstract, this equation should be confined to the dustbin of history for the following reasons. One, by focusing on time slices, it violates the very spirit of relativity. So that's the argument of breaking kind of covariance explicitly. Second, scores of man years, well, that wasn't the time of political correctness, clearly, have been wasted by researchers trying to extract from it a natural time parameter. I told you, well, there's a problem of time that becomes very obvious in this canonical approach. Third, since good path integral techniques exist for basing quantum theory on gauge invariant observables only, it seems a pity to drag in the paraphernalia of constrained Hamiltonian systems. And it goes on in this spirit. Well, this is just one person's opinion. I should say there has been a shift also just in part for looking at these very hard problems one has difficulties in solving back toward the path integral. And here, let me give you another quote from DeWitt. He says then elsewhere, well, for me, the functional integral must be the starting point. And his argument was also that there is really no very clean derivation of this equation from the path integral formulation albeit in some kind of approximation. So, but of course, that was all referring to specific context, and you should yourself investigate whether these are valid arguments or not. But be that as it may, what we'll do for the purposes of the rest of these lectures, we'll actually go back to a path integral formulation and look at various aspects of what it entails to do this non-perturbatively. So that is in contrast to what we learned in the first week of a standard perturbative quantization of gravity, and also how one can think of doing this, just as was mentioned in this De Witt quote, in terms of gauge invariant observables. So where one has already got rid of diffeomorphisms in the formulation itself. Okay, so and this is what we are now going to turn to. The non-perturbative gravitational path integral now, I mean, so just let me write it down just for completeness. So I'll use a version where, for generality, I tend to include a cosmological constant term in the action. So that will, of course, appear in the amplitudes of this path integral. So formally, this is written as some measure depending on equivalence classes of G mu nu, e to the I, S, Einstein-Hilbert, G mu nu. So you see, I'm reverting to a metric formulation. I could also think about how to do this in a gauge or in a first order formalism. But there's currently no very urgent thing of doing that, because it's not that immediate, you know, kind of vast simplifications in the formalism seem to occur when doing this, on the contrary, perhaps. So let me go back to my good old-fashioned G mu news. Now, this object is, so this is sometimes called the sum over histories. Where, of course, what one has then in mind often is, well, here I'm looking kind of at metric assignments to the entire universe, well, maybe, you know, with some initial and some final time, and just look at all possible configurations it may take, and as a curved manifold. So for the time being, we're looking at pure gravity, right? So we haven't coupled any matter field. So we're talking about the empty universe, or a piece of space-time, which is empty. And here the intention is to sum over all ways, in equivalent ways, in which this can be curved. I mean, the distinct configurations where, so these here, I should write kind of the domain of this path integral are the Lorentzian metrics, modulo the diffeomorphisms on some given manifold M. Yeah? And by this quotient, I mean, this has already appeared now various times, I just mean equivalence classes. So I consider two Lorentzian metrics, G mu nu, as equivalent when they belong to the same equivalence class with respect to four-dimensional diffeomorphism. So here I only want to integrate really over what I might call the geometries. So geometries are always where I've gotten rid of the diffeomorphism is a coordinate invariance. So this here is my cosmological constant. And this, of course, is Newton's constant, as usual. Now, what I'll be interested in is not the perturbative version of this, but a background independent independent. and non-perturbative version of this path integral. Now, what do I mean by background independent? I've mentioned this briefly in the past. It really means I'm not singling out in the construction or in how I perform this path integral any given metric, you know, any given perhaps classical solution of Einstein's equation, which is, of course, different already from what I do perturbatively, where I perturb around a given classical solution. Yeah. So here, you know, I characterize it by saying this is a democratic sum. So each curve geometry, you know, enters essentially with this, well, all enter. How they are weighed is another question, but we'll see later, we'll meet a formulation where each gets exactly, you know, the same weight, each geometry. I mean, before you evaluate this, I mean, excluding this amplitude there. And non-perturbative, I have also already explained in the past, it just means we are not confining ourselves to, you know, small deviations from some given metric. So these things are, well, somewhat related, but not quite the same. And of course, there is, again, also nothing God-given that this is the only way of doing it in a background-independent way, because often, you know, it's handy at an intermediate stage to introduce some extra structure, which you would then classify as a background structure, as long as you then make sure that in the end, this dependence is accounted for or drops out. Okay, so that's one, in principle, legitimate way of proceeding. But we can also try something that's slightly more radical to say, okay, it's already built in as a formalism. What I want to do is kind of an analog of what I do classically. I have solutions. I mean, I have Einstein equations, and I solve them. And after I solve them, I know what the solutions are. So that was also, you know, a point of view I told you one can take in the quantum theory. You know, I just want to phrase a dynamical principle at the quantum level, some quantum equations which I solve, and then the answer, well, you know, that is my spacetime or my quantum spacetime. So this is what I sometimes say. I mean, this relation here is just, you know, is terribly ill-defined. It probably qualifies as the most ill-defined equation just written down. And this is usually, you know, captured by this catch-all phrase, it's formal. As formal means, it doesn't make much sense. It's a statement of intent. That is to say, you know, if, you know, I chose a nice measure here, and, you know, if I chose a domain to make this all nice and finite, perhaps regularized at an intermediate stage, and if I could then actually perform the computation, and if, you know, I would then be able to extract information, say, of observables, well, I'd be much further in making this a sensible, a meaningful equation. But a priori, it is not that. So you have to work really hard in order to make it well-defined. And you have to work even harder than for the usual perturbative quantum field theoretic path integral, which you essentially know how to handle. And we would have applied it here if it were not for the non-renormalizability this expression exhibits. OK, so what are a few concerns one has to address? And well, what will we concretely address, which difficulties associated with this path integral? So we will show how to deal with various issues I raised also earlier in the lecture. Number one is how to actually work directly on the quotient space of metrics, modular diffeomorphisms. So here, sorry, I have already used this in various contexts. Now there is yet another context where I use this curly G of M to mean exactly the quotient I wrote down there, the path integral expression of Lorentzian matrix, curved matrix, module diffeomorphisms, because that is something that gives one headaches already perturbatively to some extent. You know, the need there to introduce kind of a gauge fixing and Fadeev-Popov determinants and all that. Now, clearly, we're talking about a field theoretic context. So just like in the perturbative formulation, of course, we expect that these are a priori very divergent quantities, these path integrals. And that certainly will be here the case too. So we expect that we have to regularize this expression, certainly also in a non-perturbative context, make it finite by introducing certain cutoffs, and then systematically study the behavior of this path integral and associated other quantities as we remove the cutoffs, and then perhaps isolate divergences and get rid of them. I mean, that's just the usual story. So one has to here show how to do this, regularize. In a way that's also compatible with kind of the dynamics and the properties, the geometric properties of the domain here one is talking about. Now, thirdly, well, one reason why this is ill-defined, which it also shares with many other path integrals, is the I in the exponent, which makes this into, you know, a superposition of complex amplitudes. That, of course, that's our physical picture behind it. You superpose complex amplitudes. But it makes it very hard to discuss the convergence properties or otherwise of this object. What one does in standard quantum field theory, one weak rotates. That essentially means one works with imaginary time and is careful about what it means to analytically continue this time parameter for path integral expressions and derived expressions that involve the path integral. So we'll also need, if you really want to compute this thing explicitly, at least with currently known methods, one also has to have some kind of weak rotation. And then the idea is that you then do the computation in a purely real context, and afterwards kind of rotate back the results. Yes?
But if you think curved space-time,
yes.
Is it obvious that weak rotation is going to work?
No, it's entirely unobvious. And I hope you'll get a really lovely problem sheet I have prepared for you about this before the course is over. No, there are many subtleties. But actually, we'll meet a formalism where there exists one prescription of how to do this. But certainly, in the continuum, it's unknown how to do this. So for the continuum path integral, I mean, beyond perturbation theory, one doesn't know how to do it. So deal with the I. Well, of course, one method, one route, you could say somewhat ad hoc method you can choose is to say, well, I just start with the Euclidean path integral. And I define this to be my my fundamental object. And I then solve the Euclidean path integral, which has just an e to the minus s Euclidean gravitational action. You know, I do all the computations, and I hope that what I get out in the end has a natural continuation back to Lorentzian signature. I mean, the world could be like this, that it is really, you know, ultimately a Euclidean world. I do all my computations, you know, in this Euclidean world, and then finally just translate, maybe also for things that have to do with sufficiently large distances, I rotate things back to Lorentzian signature. So that's an attitude that people have taken in the past when they have done what's called Euclidean quantum gravity. So it's a logical possibility that this might work. It's ad hoc because there is nothing very physical about, you know, Euclidean quantum gravity. That it just means you're working with metrics of positive definite signature. And of course, well, you should realize that, of course, these are totally different things for general curved metrics. Why are they totally different things? Because, for instance, they don't know about things like causality. So they're isotropic. It's like, you know, space has four isotropic directions, which are a priori kind of, you know, qualitatively alike. That is, of course, to be contrasted with a Lorentzian metric, right? So in a Lorentzian metric, I have extra structure because, for example, in any point, I have light cones, right? Even if it's a curved manifold. And the light cones, for example, enable me to say when two points in my spacetime, you know, are causally related and which pairs are not causally related. So it's an extra structure which the Lorentzian space has, which a Euclidean space simply does not have. So if I integrate over all of those things, it's absolutely a priori unclear why this should have to do anything with the path integral where I start by integrating over those objects. Yes?
The Euclidean approach has had a few successes in terms of computing the, say, the temperature of sudden black hole space time in space.
Yes, you could say. You could say that. I would say, yeah, certain computations clearly have been done in this Euclidean way after, well, ad hoc fixing some problems that come with it. For example, the action is unbounded from below. So one has to, you know, kind of do something to argue this away. But beyond that, you're right. There are computation and thermodynamic, semi-classical computations, I would say. Of course, they are really done on a fixed background, quantum field theory on a fixed background. But of course, you have to ask yourself, is the Euclidean computation I'm doing, which part of Lorentzian physics does this capture? So, one then makes some educated, you know, guesses of what it tells one about real physics. Is this always right or always justified? I'm not completely sure, but clearly it's an underlying logic of this whole business of computing entropy, say. Yes. But what I want to emphasize is if you want also to extend this, say, beyond a semi-classical context, where you also make gravity dynamical, it's unclear what you should be doing. What one is doing now in the semi-classical, is that really kind of the zeros order term in some, you know, full quantum process, and will computations like entropy calculation, will they continue to be meaningful in the larger context of a full theory of quantum gravity? I think no one knows the answer really to these questions. So this much about the eye, and also so that I just mentioned. In answer to Tuber's question, so we have to deal somehow with the unboundedness of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So this is true for both the Lorentzian and the Euclidean version. So it's unbounded from below. That means the action can be arbitrarily negative and large. It doesn't bother you very much in this integral over amplitudes. But after you do the Wick rotation, it does bother you in a very serious way. Because it then seems to mean, you see, you're doing an integral, kind of dg Euclidean, something like this, e to the minus s Euclidean. And you're saying, this S can become arbitrarily large and negative. That just means these factors become arbitrarily positive. So they just diverge wildly, which doesn't seem, it's not promising, you know, for if you want to make this a kind of a well-defined quantity, even at a regularized level. So these questions have to be addressed. So it's just a subset. It's just a subset of the questions we're interested in. Kind of a preview of the considerable difficulties that are associated with this. Let me now very briefly go back to the case of the quantum particle and its path integral, putting an emphasis on how we are now going to generalize this construction to write down a path integral construction for full gravity. Yeah, so here is again, very quickly, my non-relativistic particle. Which I, as we mentioned before, you can just, whose path integral we can compute by working with an intermediate regularization where the time interval, this is time again, is hacked into little pieces, delta t. Let me call this unit A. And if I'm interested in an amplitude for a particle whose end, a big initial and final position are fixed to x0 and x1, I'll integrate in my path integral kind of over all piecewise straight paths between these quantities. So this is now x1, x2, x3, etc. Usually, well, you could also discretize the spatial slicer, but that's not what you do in the usual construction. You leave these continuous. So these x's are still continuous labels. But the paths, they jump, around in continuous, but certainly not differentiable manner, as viewed from the embedding kind of Euclidean space in which these paths live. Okay, so that's an important remark. Now, what is nice about this? Why is this a regularization? Because a path in this framework kind of is just a bunch of numbers. So x naught of t, so let me just start at t equal to 0. Then I have x1 of delta t, x2 of 2 delta t, etc. So as long as this is just finite, you give me this set of numbers, and that fixes the path uniquely by my demand that in between these points, it should just be a straight line. So that means that is, of course, a much simpler object than describing an arbitrary smooth curve between these two points. Right? I need an infinite set of numbers in order to do this, or some functional decomposition of some kind. So here, these are piecewise straight paths. And what now involves formulating the path integral in terms of these quantities? So highlighting some of the ingredients. So what does it mean to perform the path integral? Doing the path integral consists of a number of steps. First, to make this problem well defined, we do go to Euclidean time, or also called imaginary time. So this is just my ordinary Euclidean t of the Euclidean embedding space of my non-relativistic particle. Then we perform for fixed, say, n. If n was just a number, so if the total time interval was t, and this was just n times delta t, so for fixed n, we perform the path sum in this Euclideanized way. So let me just write this down. So these are all paths P going from x0 to x1. E to the minus s particle Euclideanized. So that's the quantity we can just compute for every path. Then, of this expression we get there, we take a continuum limit that has A, this spacing go to 0, and simultaneously n go to infinity. And finally, then we get an expression for the Green's function. So remember, I mean, first week we discussed this a little bit more, which can then be rotated back. And one thing I emphasized already then, and I'll do it here again. So please, these paths, of course, have nothing to do with classical solutions, even forgetting about the fact that they are, well, they're clearly not smooth paths, as the classical solutions would be. But also otherwise, it's just they are, as one says, they're virtual paths. So you shouldn't think of them, although it is, you know, so very intuitive, you know, thinking of them as a, you know, the particle paths. Well, they're not physical. The only physical things are expectation values that I'm going to compute, the various things I evaluate in the path integral I'm going to compute. So these are physical things, but the paths themselves, you shouldn't think of, they're not realized physical paths. They enter in a superposition and, well, in there, they have, of course, a collective kind of, a collective reality as a quantum amplitude. But, I mean, they're not individually physical objects. So what are we going to do for gravity? Well, we'll try and imitate this. Now, what happens for gravity? A path will now be in a regularized way, similar to what we did here following this Feynman prescription. It will be a piecewise flat. So you could also call this straight if you wanted to. But of course, the word we use for higher dimensional geometries is flat space-time. So that means an approximation. And what we then want to do is to sum or integrate over all these objects. And well, usually you have to fix boundary conditions. So let's just say they go from some three-dimensional geometry. Let me indicate it in this way. With a label 0, say, an initial geometry to some three geometry or equivalence class of such a thing, G1. And here, well, each one certainly, what I'll certainly do is that each one be weighed kind of with a suitable version of the gravitational action. Yeah. Yeah.
So, what is that space-time geometry? What is SG?
Geometries, that's just the plural S. Sorry, that's my lousy handwriting. And this is an equivalence class of a four-dimensional, so it's a four geometry. So we are summing or integrating over all four geometries with perhaps some measure factor here. So the idea, I mean, so the picture that people draw is something like this. So you have some initial curved three-manifold, which you think of as the spatial boundary of your four-manifold. So that's a spatial geometry. That's the object I call G3, 0. And this is a kind of final spatial geometry. Which I called G3, 1. Could also call them initial and final. So I keep these fixed in the same way as I kept the x0 and the x1 fixed. And then I'm summing over all stuff that fits in between, that happens to have these as boundaries. Okay. So any arbitrary G mu nu geometry, I mean just up to, of course, up to diffeomorphism, that I can stick in between is being summed over. So that's this kind of the space-time. It's of course a space-time geometry, the four geometry. Well, of course, there are various differences with the non-relativistic particle. One is, of course, this is a higher dimensional object. Now it's a four-dimensional object, whereas this were just one-dimensional path. Now, there is another bigger difference in that this object is not embedded in anything, right? Whereas, of course, of the path, well, I think of my just three-dimensional Euclidean space as given, and I describe the path as, you know, moving, having some coordinates in this background. Here, we are interested in solving a path integral where we are summing over intrinsic geometry. So we are summing over configurations that have a distinct intrinsic curvedness, you know, geometry, local curvature. So that's that also, of course, has a different flavor. And there's a priori also not necessarily a fixed notion of time. So I could do various things. I could either not say anything about time, then my analogy with this path integral up there would be somewhat tenuous. Or I can make just a choice of time and then compute my path integral then more like in a picture we had in classical GR, you know, as a sequence of three geometries. Yeah, so that is unspecified, you know, when one writes down these very general formal path integral formulas. But usually one does choose some kind of time, and then one can at least make use of part of the formalism, the standard formalism for the path integrals. And of course, the time plays an important role in this picture, and to describe evolution as a function of time does too. Okay, so what our tasks, I mean, one of our tasks will be is how do I come up with a nice labeling? I mean, how do I concretely, with what variables do I describe four geometries, regularized four geometries that are piecewise flat? So if you like, what is the analog of giving you this finite set of numbers, which I needed in the particle case, just to uniquely specify the path? Here's a question will be, what variables do I use to describe these regularized piecewise flat geometries? Okay, so that brings me to the next blackboard. And here we have a beautiful idea we can make use of. It's called general relativity without coordinates. And the idea to apply this to solve classical gravities to start with goes back to Tullio Reche, a long way back, as you see. Now let's see. Wow, 51 years. Now, the idea is, so what is a nice analog of piecewise straight paths? It's so-called simplicial manifolds. So what's a how do I introduce an approximation to a smooth curved manifold in any dimensions? Well, by triangulating it. That's the idea. So this is a approximation of a curved manifold M. So M with some metric assignment on it already. So a pair, how do I approximately describe a pair of a fixed topological manifold differentiable usually and a metric assignment? Well, I approximate it by a triangulation and a bunch of variables that encode the geometry of the thing. These variables are length variables, so I'm calling them Li, Li squared, for reasons that will become clear in a moment. And I'm just giving you kind of a finite list of them. Now, in order to illustrate the construction, it's easiest to do this in the first non-trivial case, which is two dimensions. Okay. Then the question is, how do I approximate kind of a two-dimensional curved surface? It's intrinsic in its intrinsic geometry. Yes. So, and the idea is you divide it up into little triangles like this. And by fiat, the interior of each triangle is flat. I mean, intrinsically flat. It's just like, you know, a piece cut out from a flat two-dimensional manifold. Minkowski space, if you're working in Lorentzian signature, or just flat Euclidean space. So, and, well, how can I nevertheless get a curved object? Well, I can pick up kind of angles, I mean, non-trivial angles. Here, by the way, I glue such triangles together. So although kind of the building blocks are individually flat, I can nevertheless pick up curvature. What I have to specify here in order to make this well-defined, I have to specify, well, what this graph is, if you like. And then I make assignments of length variables to all of its edges, one-dimensional edges, L1 squared, L2 squared, L3 squared. So why do I decide to write them as squares? Because that, in an easy way, will allow me to cover the case when these are space-like, time-like, or even light-like. Okay. So think of these as physical geodesic lengths assignment, which are squared to allow for various signatures. Yes. And defining then a piece of curved manifold, albeit piecewise flat. So, of course, if I sit at a point here in the interior of a triangle, I will only see that it's flat there. But it can be non-flat at these vertices. Unfortunately, I didn't bring my... I'll show you tomorrow. I'll bring you my deficit angle demonstration. So... And in order to fix this completely, I just have to tell you what T is, and I have to tell you what these length assignments are. And a length assignment to the three edges of a triangle kind of completely fixes what this triangle is. So all geometric questions you could ever ask of it are encoded in these data. So that totally describes the piecewise, in this case, a piecewise flat two-dimensional space. So these are, so this is a triangulation. Triangulation. So how is geometry encoded in this prescription? There is, it's handy to think of that in two, as being split up in two pieces of information. Firstly, kind of the connectivity of T. So I have a, you know, I have a finite bunch of lattice links somehow. How do I put them together? And there are, of course, various ways of writing this down as a connectivity matrix or other. So this is the connectivity of the lattice. And secondly, the edge length. And these two things together fix everything. So what are kind of building blocks in the various dimensions? Well, they're just generalizations of triangles, but also if you go to lower dimensions, they have a definite geometric form. So what is a zero-dimensional simplex or a d-simplex? So it's called d-simplex. This is just like a d-dimensional triangle. But in d equal to zero, a zero-simplex is just a point, a vertex, a one simplex is a link, an edge between two vertices. A two simplex is a triangle spanned by three vertices, three dimensions. We get tetrahedra like this. In four dimensions, we get something that's called a four-simplex, right? So we don't have any special names for that. So that I can draw this, can try and draw this, as having a downstairs here, kind of a three-simplex. And now all the corners of the three-simplex are connected to one common extra simplex I put up here, etc. So this works in any dimension. And you can immediately work out, in principle, you know, what all geometric properties of such an object as a function of the edge lengths. Now, over here, I mean, you can compute the volume. You can compute the area of all the faces. By definition, the interior is flat, right? So that just fixes everything, giving you the edge length here. Has to be a little bit careful about the edge length. They have to satisfy triangle inequalities. So it's not true that any bunch of numbers I give you correspond to nice, say, triangles. Because it has always to be the case that, you know, the length of one of the edges cannot be longer than the sum of the other two. Okay, so one has to be slightly careful here. But so that's a basic idea. So and by definition, the interior geometry of these things is flat. Is flat. Now, what it is, that depends on the signature. So this also works in any signature. Of course, usually we are interested in signature minus plus plus plus. If you do Euclidean things, we are interested in signature plus, 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 plus. But you could also have other signatures, you know, with several time directions. But so this formalism is very flexible in allowing you to do this. And the last thing I just want to write down is how to connect back. How to connect back with kind of a metric formulation. So the beauty of this is you're not introducing coordinates at all. So you're just giving these length assignments. And from that, you can compute all geometric properties, including curvature properties, as we'll get to tomorrow. Okay. Now, of course, what you can do, if you want, for some reason wanted, you can reintroduce coordinates on these triangular building blocks. Right. There's no one stopping you to do this. There's obviously an infinity of possibilities to do this. So that's kind of then, of course, you meet again the redundancy of introducing coordinates to something that is a given geometric quantity, right? But you can do it. For example, you can do it in every simplex. And then, of course, it's just a choice because the thing is flat. It's a choice of coordinate system per simplex. And one particular one I can show you for two simplex, so a single triangle is like that. You are given length assignments, L1 squared, L2 squared, L3 squared. Now, I'm choosing coordinates where a coordinate system where this is 0, this is x, and this is y. And I'm thinking of that kind of as a unit vector. I'm choosing the coordinate system in which this is a unit vector, and that is another unit vector. So it's a non-orthogonal system. But that's just one possible choice I can make. Now, once I make a choice, then I get a precise expression for what the metric is. With any choice, I get a concrete functional form of what the metric is in terms of the coordinate system x, y chosen. And here, I'm not sure, it may or may not be in one of your exercises. What g mu nu turns out to be as a function of the edge length is L1 squared, 1/2 L1 squared plus L2 squared minus L3 squared, symmetric, so that is the same, the entry down here, L1 squared plus L1 squared plus L2 squared minus L3 squared. And this is L2 squared. So you see, we have now a totally explicit form of the metric in a specific coordinate system. If I had chosen a different coordinate system, it would look different. And here enter exactly the data I had to give you in order to make this well-defined. And you can just think about where this comes from and the beautiful fact that this works for various signatures. So if some of these are light-like, so the L1 squareds are actually negative, this works just as well. Okay. See you again tomorrow.